Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to today's occasional lecture. When we first started these occasional lectures back in 1989, they were very much occasional. And interestingly, one of the very first people that we had along to give a lecture was the then Auditor General, the late John Taylor. And his paper was entitled, "The Auditor General, Ally of the People, the Parliament and the Executive." In the same batch of those early occasional lectures, we also had the then Commonwealth Ombudsman, Professor Dennis Pearce, and the President of the Administrative Review Council, Professor Cheryl Saunders. So we thought it was high time we came back to see what had happened to the Auditor General over those years. And today it's our great pleasure to bring to you the current Auditor General, Ian McPhee. He was appointed to that position in 2005, but he's had 40 years service to public sector auditing and finance. And for his outstanding public service, he was recognised in 2002 with a public service medal. So it's a great pleasure and privilege today to welcome Ian McPhee. Thank you.
Thanks, Rosemary, and good afternoon, everyone. It's great to see you all here. And I've noticed a few former members of the Australian National Audit Office here too, so it's lovely to see them as well. I'm particularly pleased to be presenting this lecture on this occasion because it's the 110th anniversary of the Australian National Audit Office this year. My predecessor, Pat Barrett, gave the lecture in 2002 after John Taylor, and his focus at that stage was on accountability in the 21st century and how the Audit Office assists the Parliament and the wider public sector more generally. And there's certainly a flavour of that in my address here this afternoon. But because of the significant milestone in the history of the office, I thought I'd sort of look backwards a little bit as well as looking forward and comment a little bit about the challenges that we are seeing and responding to in the public sector context in the 21st century. Paramount, of course, is the role, the important role that the office plays and its relationship with the Parliament and the public. The first Commonwealth Parliament created the Office of Auditor General in 1901 as an independent public official with wide powers of investigation to scrutinise Commonwealth administration and provide independent, impartial assessments on the state of the public accounts. The Audit Act 1901 was the fourth piece of legislation of the Commonwealth Parliament. It followed the passage of two supply bills and the Acts Interpretation Act. So you can see from that just how important the first Parliament viewed the Auditor General Act of the day. In fact, Sir George Turner, in introducing the Audit Bill in July in 1901, described it as a bill that the legislature needed to enact in order to provide that the work of the government may be properly carried out. The original Act stipulated the personal powers, duties and responsibilities of the Auditor General and allowed him to appoint inspectors to assist with the execution of his duties and his responsibilities. In addition, the Auditor General was able to delegate his authority to his inspectors, but he did retain sole responsibility for reporting his findings to the Parliament. And just as an aside, while I may delegate my responsibilities in terms of reporting to the Parliament, I haven't, other than when I'm away on holidays or away overseas, because I think it's important as an Auditor General to maintain the special relationship between the Auditor General and the Parliament, so I've not delegated that responsibility to anyone else in my office. The first Auditor General, John Israel, began establishing the Audit Office in Melbourne in 1902, where he established a central office there. He then moved to establish state branch offices and develop procedures to allow the audit of the government's accounts. He was assisted in his undertaking of the audits during the early period by contracted staff from state auditors general. And by 1905, though, all audits were conducted by the Auditor General and his staff, and the office moved to Canberra in 1935 in line with government policy of the day, and many of the staff of the office at that stage stayed at the Currajong Hotel and the Hotel Acton, as did many other public servants of the era. So the Australian National Audit Office is just one of a handful of bodies that can trace its existence back to Federation, the others being the Prime Minister's Department, Foreign Affairs, Attorney General, Treasury, Defence, and separately, of course, the High Court. So as you would expect for an organisation that's been operating since Federation, there's been a number of significant shifts in our mandate and in the audit approaches that we undertake to fulfil our statutory responsibilities. Across the years, there's been 14 Auditors General, and Mr. Israel, the first Auditor General, actually held office for 25 years, as there was no retirement age, and so he kicked on until he was 75 years and 10 months, and he, in fact, died in office. So after Mr. Israel's passing, the Parliament decided it was time to introduce an age retirement on the Auditor General, and they did that to 65, and subsequent changes have seen that changed again to an Auditor General having a 10-year non-renewable term. So as part of the paper that I've provided and which will be available at the end of my lecture here today, I've provided a list of the Auditor General and tried to highlight their particular contributions across the years. To date, all of the Auditor Generals have been male, but given the composition of my office and the public service today, where women are more than 50% of the staff, I'm confident that this run of males won't extend too much longer. In the early days, the Audit Office undertook a 100% check of transactions through the government. As a result, the Auditor General examined and checked every cash sheet statement of payments and receipts to verify their legality and their accuracy. And the reason for that was because the Act referred in various sections to words such as all, every, in full, whole. And so that was the basis for the 100% checking regime. So during the incumbency, the first three Auditors General in particular, the practices of auditing largely consisted of bookkeeping examinations, checking transactions, verifying accounts, checking vouchers and stores, counting equipment, and even weighing gold and other precious metals. And, of course, the audits focused on legality and the statutory authority of transactions. There were many challenges in this early period. Two of note were the introduction of commercial activities in government and the second being the impact of the First World War. The Post Office produced its financial statements on an accrual basis in 1913 and submitted them for audit. And in the same year, the Audit Office had the challenging task of auditing the first commercial public financial institution, the Commonwealth Bank. So the Auditor General was confronted with these financial statements in this new style, the accrual form, where there were not just cash information, but information about assets and liabilities and assumptions around depreciation and other estimation techniques. And so the office had to get across this new style of reporting in an era when there were no accounting standards per se. So that was one challenge. But as I mentioned, the second one was the outbreak of the First World War. And the second element of that was that the growing decentralisation of Commonwealth administration was another issue that the early Audit Office had to take account of. And the 100% checking regime, of course, was presented with some challenges in this area, and the Audit Office found itself increasingly falling into an audit backlog. So the audit model wasn't working, of course, in this new world. With the onset of the war, there was dramatic expansion in the activities and expenditure of defence. As a consequent, the extent of the audit function increased to a scale not envisaged at Federation. But nevertheless, the office maintained its approach to the comprehensive audit practices, and it insisted on pursuing the verification of all wages payments made by the Department of Defence, insisting that pay sheets be returned from overseas and checked to ensure they were signed off. And in similar vein, I'm told that audit inspectors demanded to see the returned empty cartridge boxes as proof that their contents had been used. So, it looked like a pretty tough period for the audit office. But it wasn't until 1920 that amendments to the Act were made so that the 100% check environment was formally abolished. And the then Treasurer, Sir Joseph Cook, argued that the Auditor-General should be given greater discretion to dispense with parts of detailed audits as he considered appropriate. In moving the amendments, Cook told Parliament, "We relieve him, that is the Auditor-General, of all sections which fetter him now and say to him, as one would say to any auditor, conduct your own audit in your own way, so long as you take care that the monies which you audit have been voted by the Parliament and see that they are being spent in a constitutional manner." Those are the only two limitations we propose to place upon him, ceasing henceforth from giving him directions as to the manner in which he shall conduct his audit. And I can tell you, even today, even though there is no requirement, one thing that we as an office do pay particular attention to is the importance of spending in accordance with parliamentary appropriations. So from Federation until the early 70s, there was a predominant focus in the audit work towards assessing financial compliance and adherence to relevant laws and regulations. However, there were moves afoot to place program evaluation and audits which focused on performance on the public sector management landscape. The 1976 Coombs Commission, the Royal Commission into Australian Government Administration, was the genesis for performance auditing in the Australian federal sphere. With the announcement of the Royal Commission, the then Auditor-General, Don Steele Craik, was quick to seize the opportunity to place efficiency audits on the agenda, arguing that the parliamentary scrutiny would be greatly improved if a fresh approach to the role of the Auditor-General could be engineered, allowing Parliament to have independent and expert advice on the degree of economy and efficiency achieved in government financial administration. Steele Craik presented two submissions to the Commission and gave evidence, arguing that, as it then was, he had no specific authority to evaluate such important considerations as value for money and unproductive expenditure in terms of program delivery. In its report, the Royal Commission came to the view that if, as the Commission proposed, departmental managers were to be given a clearer responsibility for their managerial functions and greater freedom and discretion to perform them, it was important that the quality of their performance be subject to critical review. The Commission proposed that there be a regular program of efficiency audits in which departmental performance would be assessed. The Commission saw little merit in creating a new organisation to undertake these efficiency audits. It did canvass whether the Treasury or the Public Service Board may be best placed to undertake this function, but at the end of the day, the Commission judged that it would be most appropriate for the role of the Auditor General to be extended to conduct efficiency audits, as it is similar in principle to the audit function currently performed. Steele Craik was also successful in getting government acceptance that the Audit Office should be the body to undertake efficiency audits or performance audits, and he was able to persuade the Fraser government to accept the recommendation of the Coombs Royal Commission against Treasury advice. Thus, Steele Craik's lasting legacy was persuading the government to pass legislation which gave the Audit Office the efficiency audit powers. It's important perhaps to observe at this place that the office does not have a role in commenting on the merits of government policy in its audit work, but rather is focused on assessing whether government programs have been implemented efficiently and effectively in accordance with legislation and government policy. In situations where an incidental aspect of an audit we observe aspects of government policy that would benefit from a review, we have recommended departments consider the position and, as appropriate, provide advice to the responsible minister. For me, this is a responsible position for the office to take in such circumstances without commenting, of course, on the merits of such policy. So with the extended mandate that the office had, efficiency audits were conducted by a separate team of multidisciplined professionals, and these audit reports were then and today are separately tabled in the Parliament. Steele Craik argued that a fairly long lead time was necessary to evaluate the success of the new mandate, and the Efficiency Audit Division, which as a young person working in the audit office at that stage, people used to refer to as the Golden Division, because other audit divisions perceived it got special treatment at the time, got to work on this program of audits. Now, they had a few false starts, and there was some there was a constant cloud of external reviews, and the Public Accounts Committee provided some criticism because the office did struggle to get on top of some of the early audits. They are quite difficult to manage even to this day. They're harder than one might think to make sure we get the understanding right, get the analysis sorted out, form our conclusions, write the report, liaise with agencies, complete the work in a reasonable time, and make sure we address the significant issues. So in the early days, of course, the office didn't have a very sound methodology. It was developing it, and I guess it was to be expected to some extent. The Public Accounts Committee did do a review of the Audit Office in 89 and had a look at the performance of the office against the efficiency audit powers and recommended the office continue to have responsibility for efficiency audits. The committee also made some other important recommendations to strengthen the independence of the Auditor General, namely that for the legislation to state unequivocally that the Auditor General is an officer of the Parliament in order to emphasise the Auditor General's relationship with the Parliament. Secondly, the right of the JCPA to veto the person proposed by the government to be appointed as Auditor General. I think this is the only appointment where currently a parliamentary committee has such a veto, and it's most unusual for government to agree to a parliamentary committee to veto an appointment, but that's the statutory position in relation to the Auditor General. As I mentioned earlier, the 10-year non-renewable term. And the other important thing is the Public Accounts Committee to have a role in recommending the resources of the Australian National Audit Office to the Parliament. And finally, the Australian Audit Office to be renamed the Australian National Audit Office. So the new legislation, which was under development for quite a long time after the Public Accounts Committee report in 89, so the legislation was under development since from the early 1990s right through to its enactment in 1997. It was a very sound piece of legislation in its day. The issue, of course, was getting priority for it from a government point of view. And I was working in the finance department at the time and endeavouring to get a higher priority for the introduction of the audit legislation, but also the Financial Management Accountability Act and the Commonwealth Authorities and Companies Bill. When a senior minister of the then Labor government, explaining the then priority the government had allocated to the legislation, said to me that the issue of the new package of audit legislation and the other legislation was not showing up in the door knocks. So it just goes to show that, you know, when it comes to matters of public administration, sometimes they don't get the priority that other matters are accorded by government. Nevertheless, despite the long gestation period and the inquiries by the Public Accounts Committee, the new legislation came into effect on January 1, 1998 and provided a solid financial statement and performance audit mandate, with the only real carve-out being in relation to performance audits of GBEs, which required an invitation from the JCPAA for the Auditor General to perform such audits. The basis for the carve-out was fairly thin then, namely that the focus of GBE accountability in future was to be on results, and against this background, the government considered there was little to be gained by subjecting GBEs to efficiency audits, such as the discipline as the discipline to be efficient is imposed through the focus on targets and related performance measurement. The argument for this carve-out from the Auditor General's mandate is even thinner today than it was back then, particularly as the stable of GBEs has more than halved to seven following asset sales, but they still include significant bodies such as NBN Company Limited. In the ANAO's submission to the recent inquiry by the Public Accounts Committee into our legislation, the Office argued that the Auditor-General should have the discretion to undertake performance audits of GBEs, which the Committee agreed with, essentially making the case for the Auditor-General to have the complete discretion to undertake performance audits of any Commonwealth-controlled entity. I make further reference to the Committee's support for enhancing the mandate of the Auditor-General later in this presentation. The Audit Office has continued to audit the financial statements of all Commonwealth departments and entities since its early days. I mentioned the Commonwealth Bank and the Post Office earlier. All statutory bodies were adopting accrual reporting in the mid-1980s, and it wasn't until November 1992 that the Australian Government agreed that public sector departments and agencies should also move to adopt accrual accounting. Prior to that, they presented information on a cash basis or a modified cash basis. This was a very big decision at the time, particularly for departments, but I think a very important step for the government to take. And just to give you an illustration of the difference, I suppose, between the traditional approach and the new style approach where all assets and liabilities, revenues and expenses are displayed, government superannuation. Currently, the outflows for government superannuation is about $6.7 billion a year. That is the cash payments going out from the consolidated revenue to pay for pensions, $6.7 billion. But the actual total full liability for pension obligations is around $140 billion. So you can see with a cash basis, all you're seeing is the 6.7 flow, but with the comprehensive accrual basis, you're seeing both the cash flow, but you're also seeing the total obligation or the total liability. So it certainly provides much more comprehensive information, and it was certainly a beneficial step. The office was very supportive of this approach, and as departments moved to adopt accrual reporting, the office was involved and assisted in that approach. The Audit Office now audits some 260 financial statements each year, as well as the government's accounts as a whole. Accounting and auditing standards are a whole lot more demanding and complicated, seem to be getting more demanding and complicated each year. And certainly it is quite demanding as an audit practice to keep up to date with the changes in both the accounting and the auditing standards. I signed the audit opinions on the financial statements of the Australian Government and 10 of the most significant entities, including the Reserve Bank, the Future Fund, Australia Post, the Broadcasting Corporation, and a number of significant departments. And my senior staff signed the balance of the audit opinions under delegation. I can assure you that I'm very conscious of the responsibilities that come with signing such opinions, as are my senior staff and team members. Conscious of the responsibilities as well. We certainly understand that the Parliament and the wider community take confidence from our work and our audit opinions in this area. In addition to our financial statement work, the Office has continued to develop its audit products and services to act as a catalyst for improving public administration. Our highly regarded series of better practice guides were introduced in 1987 by John Taylor, the then Auditor General. And the first one was a better practice guide on asset management. These better practice guides are designed to give examples of sound practice that should be adopted by the whole of the Australian public sector. Initially, they were produced on an ad hoc basis, but in later years, they've become an integral part of our audit strategy. We reinforce our audit findings and recommendations through the publications of our better practice guides, which are designed to provide practical guidance to agencies to promote better practice in specific areas of public administrations. Their guides are seen as Bibles in some areas of public administration. They are certainly warmly received by agencies. In fact, some agencies would prefer we produce more better practice guides and did less audits, but we're not quite going that far. The office today has a staff of 350 people and a budget of $78 million. This represents 0.01% of the combined revenues and expenses of the Australian Government. So it's a very modest price to pay for assurance provided by the ANAO, and as you will have worked out, that requires us to take an approach which focuses on risk and materiality so that we put our resources where they're required to provide responsible reports to the Parliament. Our vision is to be an international leader in the provision of independent public sector audit and related services. As I touch on shortly, we do not duck auditing contentious topics. We seek to operate efficiently, as you would expect us to do, and we seek to improve our own performance over time. We seek to maintain effective relationships with agencies and government, and most of the time, we generally do that. We have wide powers of access to all documents created by government, including cabinet papers, and may take evidence on oath from any person to aid the conduct of audits of Commonwealth entities. That said, it's quite rare for the office to be required to formally seek documents or take evidence on oath because most agencies, most ministers understand our powers and see the good sense in cooperating. I've only used my formal powers to take evidence on oath on a small number of occasions in my more than 6 years in the role. The most recent and high profile where I did use those powers was the report on the Department of Treasury in relation to motor dealer financing assistance, or colloquially referred to as Ausgate or Utegate in some areas. Where there were questions raised in the Parliament and the media concerning financing assistance for individual motor dealers, and in particular whether one representation made by an acquaintance of the then Prime Minister, by Mr John Grant, had received favourable treatment. This led to questions as to whether the then Prime Minister and or the Treasurer may have misled the Parliament. I was asked to conduct an urgent investigation into these allegations. The audit found that favourable treatment had not been given to the Prime Minister's acquaintance, but the audit highlighted a range of fairly significant matters in relation to Treasury's implementation of the assistance scheme and raised serious questions about the conduct of the senior departmental official primarily responsible for the implementation of the policy response to motor dealer industry liquidity issues, including improper use being made of confidential information by that official. In these sensitive audits, we have discussions with ministers and the CEO of responsible agencies to make sure we have a clear understanding of the issues to inform our audit report. Evidence was taken on oath from the then Prime Minister, the Treasurer, and other key identities involved. I felt at the time it was important to use the full extent of the powers the Parliament had provided me to get to the bottom of the central issue on which the audit was focused. In addition to gathering evidence in this way, the audit involved forensic analysis of email traffic between the various ministerial offices, the Treasury, and the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet. I should also add that this audit was completed in 6 weeks from declaration to tabling, which was a Herculean effort by the audit team, considering the work involved and the time allowed for respondents to provide comments on the draft report before tabling. The largest performance audit we have ever done in the office was the three-volume, 1,200-page performance audit of the Regional Partnerships Program, which also included 12 case studies for good measure. The audit highlighted a poor standard of administration of the Regional Partnerships Grants Program and some bias in the distribution of grants to recipients in seats held by the then government. Of particular note in these respects was the significantly higher tempo of funding applications, project approvals, and announcements that occurred in the 8 months leading up to the calling of the 2004 federal election compared to the remainder of the 3 years examined by the office. A surge in grant approvals and announcements occurred during this period, notwithstanding that many of the projects recommended and approved for funding were underdeveloped such that they did not demonstrably satisfy the program assessment criteria. The report was also a little controversial in being tabled out of session just 10 days out from a federal election. The decision to table a report at this time was not a difficult decision for me to make, because to table such a report after the election on a program for which the government was accountable would have made the office appear, in my view, limp, particularly when the office had a history of tabling reports out of session in the caretaker period and given the extensive consultation that had occurred with the administering department and the responsible ministers to ensure that they were provided with every opportunity to provide their perspective on the issues raised by the audit. While the timing of the report aroused some comment at the time, most appreciated there was little choice here. The ANAO has followed this audit with a series of audits on grants administration, showing how the approach to assessing grant applications and making recommendations to ministers needed serious improvement. The key point that we've been on about for a long time in these grants audits is the importance of treating applicants in an equitable manner, consistent with the government's policy and with their criteria articulated in the grant guidelines. It's a fairly straightforward and simple message, but it's one we have reinforced. And the good news is the government responded in 2009 with a substantially upgraded framework for the administration of grants. So our work, I try and use our work to get maximum leverage to improve public administration. Another audit which caused my name to drop off a few Christmas card lists for a while was the performance audit of parliamentary entitlements that we did in September 2009. I often say, you know, occasionally we get offside with one side of the parliament or the other with some of our reports. Well, on this one we managed to get the quinella. And but the problem was the system of grants administration needed system of parliamentary entitlements needed serious attention. It was difficult for members of parliament to deal with. It was difficult for the finance minister and his department to administer. And so we, our report did lead again to a review of those arrangements by government and improvements in the administration of parliamentary entitlements as well. We've undertaken also some very important reviews of major defence acquisition projects and government advertising to strengthen public administration in those areas which historically have had their own issues. There are many other areas where our contribution has made lasting improvements to the way programs are delivered by agencies. While the Defence Department has been on the receiving end of some of our more critical audit reports, I do want to recognise the efforts of the Department in overcoming the most significant financial reporting issues any agency had in preparing their financial statements on an accrual basis. While the Department went through a dark period in 2004 and 2005 when we issued a disclaimer of audit opinion on the Department's financial statements due to the levels of uncertainty with respect to the information reported, that meant we couldn't really give a positive opinion on their accounts. The then Minister and the Department took up the challenge to remedy their accounts and many of the underlying systems issues to allow a clear audit to be given in subsequent years. This wasn't just overcoming the financial statement issues, but was seen by the Department and the Minister as a matter that affected the Department's credibility when it came to a much broader range of budgetary and financial matters. It was a credit to those involved, including Rick Smith, who was the Secretary, General Peter Cosgrove, the Chief of the Defence Forces, and the staff in the Defence Organisation. Of course, my staff also put in a very substantial effort to ensure Defence received timely feedback on their approach to remediation and the audit results. But it was a very good case study of how an agency with effective leadership and working to, to a clear strategy in consultation with the office can turn a challenging situation around. Our work certainly underlines the importance of public sector entities giving emphasis to the fundamentals of leadership, governance, management and underlying scorekeeping arrangements. It seems we all need to be reminded about these fundamentals from time to time. Our audit reports tend to be understated for effect, and we have consciously reduced the number of recommendations we produce to focus only on significant matters. Some agencies have suggested tongue-in-cheek that it is their improved performance which has led to the reduction in their recommendations. Well, while there's no doubt some truth in this, it would be too early for most agencies to be walking to the winner's circle just yet. It's quite rare for agencies not to agree with our conclusions because we do work hard at getting a full understanding of their program and their administration. and we seek to engage them at senior levels during the course of the audit. We work hard to improve the quality of our audits over time, and we certainly invest heavily in the professional development of our staff. We provide solid technological support to our audit teams and access to key specialist resources under panel arrangements. I can say that the pursuit of cost-effective approaches to delivering better quality services is never far from my mind, and we continue to focus on improving our own performance and the quality of our work. We endeavour to also try and answer what I call the so what question. So what do all these findings mean? So what are we saying in this report? To try and pull together some of the technical considerations to answer the high level and important questions about what is the state of the administration of the program we are looking at. A strong indication of the standing of the office, I think, and the value of the work it has undertaken over the years is the support shown by the JCPAA, particularly in their recent report 419, tabled in Parliament in December last year, where they recommended an extension of the Auditor General's mandate, particularly in relation to enabling the Auditor General to review an agency's compliance with its performance indicator, the model being that in the longer term, agencies would have their performance information, in some cases subject to audit similar to the financial statement audit at the end of the year. So we would look at some performance information, look at the financial statements and provide an opinion on both. The second important area was enabling the Auditor General to conduct performance audits of state and territory entities that receive Commonwealth funding, where there is a corresponding or reciprocal responsibility to deliver specified outcomes in accordance with agreed arrangements if a minister or the JCPA requests this. This is commonly called powers to follow the money, and I guess a straightforward illustration of this was if we had these powers and there was a program like the Building the Education Revolution, where we did do a performance audit which focused on the education department's administration of the Commonwealth end of the BER program, if we had to follow the money powers, we would also be able to look at the performance of state entities in how they utilise the Commonwealth funding and to be able to provide commentary on the performance of those entities in the utilisation of the Commonwealth funding and perhaps compare and contrast different approaches taken by different jurisdictions and hopefully beneficially draw out some of the positive approaches and some of those approaches which didn't work so well. So that's just a proposal at this stage. The other important recommendation of the committee was to allow the Auditor General to conduct performance audits of contractors that are engaged to assist in the delivery of Commonwealth programs. This proposal had particularly strong support from Dr. Steve Gumley, who was the head of the Defence Materiel Organisation at the time, and I think we're in agreement in this space that in this era where we talk in public administration about partnership arrangements with contractors, and particularly in the defence space where the DMO has to work very closely with industry, our focus currently and as under the legislation is our focus strictly on defence or the Defence Materiel Organisation, not how the contractor's gone. I think in this era of partnership, it's perhaps time to be able to look at the performance of some of these significant contract arrangements as well, and the performance of the contractor. Because sometimes, even though defence will end up with carrying the issues, the problems can very much be with contractors as well. So we'll see how that goes. But the message is, I think the world of public administration has moved on since 1997. And if the committee's recommendations are accepted, then we would see some fairly significant changes again to the mandate of the Australian National Audit Office. So the follow-up to that committee report is that Rob Oakeshott, who's the chair of the Public Accounts Committee and, of course, the independent member for Lyne, introduced a private members' bill, the Auditor General's Act Amendment Bill 2011, into Parliament in February this year, designed to give legislative effect to the committee's recommendation. The legislation, as amended, has now been passed by the House of Representatives, and the proposed legislation is being debated by the Senate. These amendments to the audit legislation are certainly the most significant since the office was given the performance audit mandate, and in some ways more wide-ranging, as it is proposed that the Auditor-General be able to assess the performance of the recipients of Commonwealth Government funding and contractors engaged to assist with the delivery of government programs and activities. Such changes, if enacted, will bring with them the responsibility on the Auditor-General and the Office to exercise the powers judiciously in those areas which are significant to the delivery of programs being administered by jurisdictions with funds provided by the Commonwealth, and in relation to contractors where their performance is central to the delivery of programs and activities. The proposed legislation does not substantially change the position with respect to the audit of GBEs by the Auditor-General. It seems such an amendment to give the Auditor-General the authority to undertake a performance audit of a GBE at his or her discretion may have to wait another day. As a highly respected audit office amongst our peers, the office also seeks to make a contribution to public sector auditing internationally. My office is active in a range of international and regional groupings, and we seek to contribute to the best of our ability. One of the things, I guess an indicator that I take in terms of the standing of the office, is that last year we were asked to undertake lead an international peer review of the Canadian Audit Office, and we reported on that last year and provided evidence to their equivalent of the Public Accounts Committee. And this year I've been asked by the Auditor General of India to undertake a similar international peer review of the Indian Audit Office. I've got to tell you, I was a bit apprehensive about that one and the scale of it, but in fact we've got a team going over next week just to scope out the peer review of the performance audit part of the practice, but they're very keen for us to do it, so we'll do the best that we can. Closer to home, and like a number of Australian government agencies, the office is also engaged in capacity development programs with specific countries in our region, primarily Indonesia and Papua New Guinea, which is funded through AusAid. Our relationship with the Indonesian Board of Audit dates back to the Boxing Day tsunami of 2004, when, as part of the Australian government's response to assist Indonesia, support was also offered to strengthen public sector institutions. We have got an SES officer based up in Jakarta. We have got a very good relationship with the Indonesian Board of Audit, and we have some of their staff working with us in our office, and it seems to be going extremely well. We've had an even stronger and longer relationship with the Papua New Guinea Auditor General's office. Again, we've got an SES officer posted in Port Moresby, and we have twinning arrangements where staff of the PNG office come and work with us, and about 20% of the current staff of the Papua New Guinea office have actually spent time on exchange with us here in Canberra. Many other countries would like to sort of take advantage of our contribution, but I have to say you just need to make choices, and certainly Indonesia and Papua New Guinea are our immediate priorities. So just to draw my remarks to a close, at the heart of the effectiveness of the role of the Auditor-General is the legislative mandate that provides for the charter and independence of the office and powers to obtain access to information and to ministers and officials as required to allow us to report to Parliament independently. This independence is critical to success, allowing the Auditor-General to report on government administration without fear or favour. Such reports assist the Parliament to hold the executive government to account and inform the wider Australian community of the state of public administration. The charter of my office has expanded in the past 110 years to grow from a focus on financial matters to include performance auditing, with the prospect of the office being able to follow the money if Parliament supports the legislation currently before it. Critically important to an effective office is an effective relationship with the Public Accounts Committee, because the committee informs the Auditor-General of the Parliament's priorities and has a role in recommending the resource levels for the office in parallel with the government's own budgetary processes.
In discharging my responsibilities, I'm very conscious that I do so with a clear view of not only the Parliament but also the citizens of Australia. We look to see the programs are appropriately implemented with wide considerations of public interest and consistent with legislation and government policy. I receive correspondence from members of the public and we always endeavour to respond in a manner that's helpful. I have a correspondent, Arthur, from regional Victoria, who drops me a line each year to find out about the government's revenues and the financial results. It's always nice to hear from Arthur, and I've got to say it makes my day sometimes just to pick up some of this correspondence, which is actually supportive of the role of the office. We can't always help in every occasion, but we'll do their best to give citizens a steer as to where they might get attention if we can't do something about it. I also get, of course, a range of requests from ministers and probably more requests from shadow ministers as to particular audit topics I might like to focus on. Sometimes we do, sometimes we don't. But the good thing is that the legislation allows the decision to me and I make it in the best interest of the priorities that we have in front of us. During my time as Auditor-General, we've managed to maintain effective working relationships with key stakeholder groups. We are fortunate to meet many members of Parliament as they become involved in parliamentary committee work early in their careers in Parliament. This assists greatly at a later time when they become ministers and auditor issues arise in their portfolios. As I always say, best to meet people in the good times. You don't want to meet them first when you're having a bit of a dust-up. I should say, though, that it's important that it's important that I say this, that no government minister or other member of Parliament has ever sought to improperly influence my presentation of audit findings. I'm a strong believer in those being audited being accorded natural justice. And on all of the significant audits, I'll go and talk to the Chief Executive. I'll talk to the Minister if appropriate. And I'll sort of say, well, this is what we're about to say about the administration of your program. What do you think? And I'll listen to what they have to say. Some cases they'll say, well, you know, you've probably got it about right. Other cases they might have a few points that are worth taking into account. We might adjust the report. But I'm a great believer in direct speaking and hearing directly from the senior executives and ministers. As you would expect, from time to time, there's been some fairly robust discussions where ministers and CEOs have strongly presented their perspective, but properly done. This generally adds to the understanding of issues on both sides. Occasionally it also adds a bit of colour, but most importantly it reflects well on our system of government here in Australia and respect for our institutional arrangements. In August this year, the Prime Minister sent the office a message on the occasion of our 110th anniversary, where she reflected with admiration and gratitude on the truly remarkable contribution to public administration made by the Australian National Audit Office over 110 years. The Prime Minister generously recognised the rigour and independence of our work and the contributions we are making to support improved governance in our region, especially Indonesia and Papua New Guinea. Certainly, in my view, the office has moved with the times. Today, it has a broad mandate, is appropriately resourced to allow me to discharge my responsibilities as Auditor General, and through its work, assist the Parliament to hold the executive government to account. And we've certainly brought about considerable changes in public administration for the better. This position is a result of strong support from the Parliament and citizens of Australia, respect from successive governments, and the dedication and commitment of staff in the office. With the challenges ahead of the public sector in delivering public services better and providing advice on policy solutions in an increasingly complex world, the role of the office will be even more important in the years ahead. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Ian. And we do have a little bit of time for questions this afternoon. I'm going to seize the chair's prerogative and ask the first question, but those who want to follow me might like to go to the microphones either side. My question is really about the workload of the office. Even without the Oakeshott Bill and its implications for the work you'll be able to do in the future, there's an enormous range of auditing work that you could do. I wonder if you'd say something about how you go about setting the the audit priorities each year and your relation, a little bit more about your relationship with the Public Accounts Committee in determining your work plans.
Certainly, I was fortunate in the early days of the Labor government to get an increase in resources for my office. Having worked in the finance department and the audit office over the years, I worked out that there's a sort of a honeymoon period in which one has to act to get support from government for additional resources for an organisation like mine. So, and I was very lucky that Senator John Faulkner was the Special Minister of State, and Lindsay Tanner, who I knew quite well, and so. With their support and with some support within the bureaucracy, we managed to get additional resources because I was quite concerned about the resourcing position of the audit office, because the reality is in my world is you must resource the financial statement work because we've got a statutory responsibility there. The balances of the office is on the performance auditing, so if you ever need to shift resources, that traditionally it had been from the performance audit to the financial statement audit, and so our performance audit program was reducing. Well, with the additional resources, we are appropriately resourced. And the way the office is structured is we do just over 50 performance audits a year, plus the 260 financial statement audits. The whole organisation is designed to produce about that many reports. Any more, I think, would be quite challenging, and I think, quite frankly, 50 reports is probably sufficient for the Public Accounts Committee to be able to absorb as well. Each year we have a very open planning process to determine the audit program for the performance audits. We clearly have our own research areas. We keep an eye on the press. We try and focus on those issues that are significant. And we've picked on particular themes where the areas where we think public administration seriously needs to be improved. We tend to do a series of audits, and grants administration is the classic case. And we've tried to do a bit of work in defence and defence acquisitions, again, to try and highlight the particular themes, areas that defence can work on. We have, an open planning process. We say, well, this is our draft plan. We ask agencies, we ask the parliamentary committees through the Public Accounts Committee for any feedback on the program, any suggestions. And at the end of the day, of course, it's my decision to decide the particular program. One of the issues that we find quite challenging is making sure we continue to get quality staff. It's not a case of just filling positions. We're a bit light on at the moment. I'd like to have some more staff, but we're pretty choosy about who we choose. So we'll just keep going until we get the right ones. So we provide a lot of training and support, but it's tough. It's doing this auditing is not for everyone, and it can be fairly tough. As I say, if you can get through it, it's very good. You know, the training you get in auditing is very good for life skills as well. You learn to look after yourself. You learn to sort of work out the wheat from the chaff and all of that sort of stuff. So it's pretty good, but it's not for everyone. In terms of working with the committee, it's quite special for me to have a relationship with a parliamentary committee. It's a statutory relationship, but it's an ongoing relationship where we both provide evidence to the committee in a formal sense. I have private meetings with the committee from time to time, and it's a very sound relationship. But one of the things that, if I could say this, I sometimes give presentations to departments about, you know, governance and organisational management, and I always make the point every organisational structure has got benefits, but also there's downsides to any structure you want to set up. And the whole plan is, of course, to maximise the positives from organisational arrangements and compensate for the downsides. One of the things about being an independent officer and with strong powers of independence, that's lots of benefits. It allows me to get on with the job, to report directly without fear or favour, to sort of do the job that the Parliament expects. The downside is, of course, there's no one that's all that close to you because of the independence. You know, if you're a secretary, you've got a minister and a hierarchy, all of that sort of stuff. We don't have anyone really sitting over the top of me other than the Public Accounts Committee, which I value. So the Public Accounts Committee is the closest thing I have to a group who can sort of provide constructive feedback to me.
I expect them to. Generally, it's pretty positive, but if they've got any issues, I'd like to hear from them as well about that. And so it is an important relationship. And the very valuable thing is that from time to time when I have needed assistance on resources, the community's been right there to provide the support, to write to the Treasurer or the Finance Minister or the Prime Minister, etc., as well to provide support for my office. So I actually think it's quite a useful and productive model. And I know some other statutory office holders would like to have equivalent arrangements in place, either with the Public Accounts Committee or similar committees.
Thank you very much. Ernst.
Thank you. My question, in effect, in substance, follows on from what you've just said, although I don't think you've completely covered it. You've emphasised the independence of the office and its role in holding the executive to account. You also referred to the role of the Auditor General as an officer of the Parliament. As I understand it, the objective of that arrangement was to secure the independence of the office from the executive. Another view, which was canvassed at the time, was that it would involve the Auditor General more in partisan politics, or that there was a risk that it would involve the Auditor General in the partisan politics of the Parliament. And we have seen in the last few days some controversy about the role of the Ombudsman in his relationship with a member of the Senate. Can you comment on what difference making the Auditor General an officer of the Parliament makes and the merits of that approach?
Thank you. When the legislation was passed to mention my role as an independent officer of the Parliament, the point was made, I think, in the explanatory memorandum that this was symbolic. It has it carries no more weight than that, but it was underlining the importance of the Auditor General's role with the Parliament. I found it very reinforcing. I'm very clear, about my role in terms of neither the government nor the Parliament can direct me in any of the audit activities I undertake. But it underlines to me, if it needed to be underlined, the relationship I have is directly with the Parliament, and to allow the Parliament to hold the executive government to account through the reports that I provide. So I don't see any particular... In fact, I think it's strengthening rather than weakening that proposal. And I think there are other, as I said earlier, other statutory office holders who would like to be in a similar position to me, and I very much appreciate the support that that sort of recommendation from the Public Accounts Committee has given to my office.
One more question over here. That might be our last one.
I noticed that you didn't refer to the state and territory audit officers. I was just wondering, under present legislation, do you at times have collaborative audits with the relevant state office when they need to look at state bodies? And under the proposed legislation of Mr. Oakeshott, there would be practical difficulties delineating your role compared with that of the state audit office.
Thank you. Very good and contemporary question, no doubt about that. I have to say that some of the proposals to follow the money haven't been universally applauded, and there's been some concern expressed by state auditor generals that we could be bumping into each other, but I think the reality is that it'll be, from my point of view, if we get the power, it'll be judiciously used, and it'll be with a particular focus on Commonwealth administration and what the Commonwealth is seeking to achieve through providing the states with the funds. So I think it can be managed, and I would propose to write to not only state auditors general but the premier's departments in each of the states if the legislation goes through to set out an approach we would take with these new powers should we get them. But that aside, there are other opportunities for us to collaborate in audits, the point that you have also raised. In the past, we have endeavoured to work collaboratively on audits, but it hasn't been a great success because priorities tend to be different. Something might be important for me but may not be important for a state auditor general, who may say, well, actually interested in that, Ian, but I don't have the resources at the moment to allocate to that. So it involves cooperation, and the auditors general in Australia are keen to cooperate more. One of the existing problems we have is the legislation that governs my role is quite restrictive, understandably, in what information I can share with other parties not directly related to the audit. So I have got full access to government information, but there's restrictions on what I can pass on, for instance, to a state auditor general. I can certainly pass on the audit objectives, the audit criteria. I can agree on timing approaches, but when it comes to passing on information that I have gained using my audit powers, then clearly there are real constraints on me. The Queensland Auditor General, interestingly, following the Public Accounts Committee in Queensland recommendation, has now got the power to be able to share information he collects under his Act with other auditors general if he believes that's in the public interest. And so I think that's an interesting development, which no doubt in time at the Commonwealth level would want to look at, and I'm sure the Public Accounts Committee will be interested in that as well, to allow auditors general to share information. I have to say there's some issues around that because, as I say, we have great powers to collect information from executive government, and executive governments may be interested to know under what circumstances an auditor general would decide to pass that information on to another jurisdiction. So there's some issues around that, but we do, and in places like Canada, they do work, the national auditor and the provincial auditors do work together on collaborative audits. And the important thing to say is that they don't have to be, it's not a case of either collaborative auditors or audits or follow the money. You can be doing both. Or style of audits, if we want. And certainly the Australian Area Auditors General meet twice a year. So I meet with the state colleagues twice a year and we exchange information and approaches and stuff. So it's a very good relationship with the states. But this follow the money stuff was designed. And I think if those of you who paid attention to the consideration of building the education revolution in this parliament, there was considerable concerns about, you know, some of the delivery in some of the areas of state, in the state delivery of that program. And the follow the money is to allow, in such circumstance, the Commonwealth General to have, Auditor General to have a closer look at the performance of the state organisations with the Commonwealth monies and report back to the federal parliament. So I think it's an interesting development. I think it's a sign of the times. The Commonwealth is trying to work under the COAG arrangements much more closely with the states, be clear about responsibilities, and I think it's a sign of the times. And similarly, the use of the follow the money for contractors. I mean, once upon a time, the Commonwealth used to do, using its own staff, a whole lot more functions than it does today. Today it outsources many responsibilities, and in some occasions there may be a case for the Auditor General to look at the performance of some of those entities, importantly doing sort of functions utilising Commonwealth funds. And so I think it's a sign of the times, and I think it'll be a useful addition to the mandate of the Auditor General should the Parliament agree to pass the legislation. Thanks, Rosemary.
Thank you. Well, sadly, our time is up. I'm sure you'll agree that Ian has thoroughly demonstrated how important it is that we have a rigorous, independent and expert Auditor General and Australian National Audit Office, how important it is for the health of public administration and our polity in general. So please join me in thanking Ian McPhee for today's lecture.